This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Reverend Andrew Greeley. He's an outspoken critic of the church who nevertheless remains committed to the priesthood. Greeley has condemned the church bureaucracy and advocates the ordination of women. He has called on the church to take a more positive and realistic view of marital sex and to sanction birth control. His views reach large audiences through his newspaper columns and books. Greeley is also controversial for his best-selling novels, in which he's explicitly described priests violating their vows of celibacy. Greeley was ordained in 1954 and spent almost a decade as a parish priest in Chicago. During that time, he completed a doctorate in sociology. In 1963, he was reassigned from the parish to full-time work as a researcher and writer. He's since conducted many sociological studies of Catholics and the Church. He's still a priest in the Archdiocese of Chicago and is also a professor of sociology at the University of Arizona, where he does weekend work in three parishes. Greeley has written an autobiography. It's titled Confessions of a Parish Priest. He told me he found the seminary very disillusioning.
I thought it would be a place where we would seriously address the problems of philosophy and theology and the problems of spirituality and prayer, and that we'd be in training to be zealous priests. In fact, the education was fourth rate. We didn't seriously address anything. And we were taught the most important virtue. In fact, the only virtue was obedience. A good priest is one who does what he's told. And I went along, as did my classmates, but I think we didn't buy that seminary at all.
You compare in your book the obedience training to behavior modification. What were some of the techniques that were used to teach obedience to the young men in the seminary?
Well, a totally routinized life where you were governed from morning to night by bells. You were never given enough time in your room. An hour and a half was the most you had in the way of a study period, so you really couldn't get too deeply involved in books, but you weren't given enough time out of your room to do anything but maybe play a brief game of basketball or softball. Everything you did, from the 5:25 bell in the morning to the 9:45 bell at night, was minutely regulated, supervised, controlled. It was to use the sociologist Herbert Gann, God be good to him to use this phrase, it was a total institution from beginning to end. And it was designed to produce externally acceptable behavior. If you went along with the rules, if you weren't caught doing anything wrong, if you adjusted to the routine of daily life, then you were fit for ordination. It was thought that such training would prepare us to be associate pastors, assistant pastors, as we would have said that day, in those days, in the archdiocese. And it might have worked if it hadn't been for the Vatican Council and the changes in the church. It might have been the life in which it might have been that a life shaped by the behavior modification techniques of the seminary would have sustained us in the priesthood. As it was, maybe 20% of those who went through the behavior mod seminary just could not adjust for one way or another to the open pluralistic church that began at the end of the Vatican Council. And so they left the priesthood.
It also seems that a lot of the theological learning that you did was by rote with, I think, true or false quizzes on it, memorization, instead of really penetrating.
Not only memorization, but memorization in Latin. And it could have been Greek, I suppose it could have been worse. On the other hand, it was also true that there was time to study and to read. I could deal with the memorizing maybe with a quarter of my study time. So I began, in about 1950, to read the great French Catholic theologians of that era, Teilhard de Chardin, Henri de Lubac, Jean Dornier Lou. And these were the men that shaped the Vatican Council. So even at ordination in 54, I had in my head the ideas which would begin to flourish in the early 60s. So I was, in this respect, too, I was much luckier than many of my contemporaries.
As celibates, you were warned to protect yourselves from women. You were warned against the ballet. What were the harms of the ballet?
Well, that is, I think, the typical incident of the seminary. It was in the winter of 1950, and we were preparing to go home for the winter vacation in January. We had to stay out there for Christmas, but we're going home in January. Bitter cold winter evening, the ancient Jesuit spiritual director came in and warned us to avoid the ballet while we were home on vacation. Well, you know, we didn't know what he was talking about. Finally, it dawned on me, and I wrote in a piece of paper and gave it to the fellow next to me, ballet. We had had the film a few weeks before called The Red Danube, based on Bruce Marshall's novel Vespers for Vienna, in which a very young Janet Leigh played a ballerina. and cavorted around for a part of the film in what might have been considered in those days a relatively skimpy ballerina costume. And apparently this poor old man was afraid that, you know, these are Irish and German and Italian and Polish kids in 1950, most of whose parents hadn't gone to college. So we were going to go home on the vacation and rush off to the ballets so we could ogle bodies like Janet Leigh's. And of course, you know, we couldn't, most of us couldn't have committed a ballet if we wanted to. We wouldn't know where to go to see it. And, but see, that it was funny, but it was also sort of tragic, because the idea was that the beautiful human body, the beautiful body of a woman, was somehow evil, and that it was not made to be enjoyed. Of course it's been made to enjoy. You respect the person, but you don't flee from it as though it's the work of the devil. And mind you, and again, in 4 years, we were going to be out working in a world which was marginally more woman than men, and some of whom might even be attractive. So it was craziness. It was just craziness. And we knew it.
What were some of the other ways that you were warned against women and told about the dangers of female sexuality?
Well, we were warned when we were home on vacation to avoid the women that we'd gone to grammar school with, because they were now at a marriage age and they would be looking for husbands. And it was really an accomplishment for a woman to win someone away from the seminary. So if we saw them in back of church after Mass, we were told to avoid them. I looked. There were none of my women classmates there, so I didn't have anybody to avoid.
What effect do you think it had on the men in the seminary to have this training about the negativity of women, like when they entered the world and when they had a parish? And as you pointed out, there were women in it.
All over the place, yes.
Do you think that it was like negative reinforcement about women?
Well, it was certainly negative reinforcement. And worse, it was keeping us in a state of immaturity. We were not developing mature, self-focusing, self-energizing patterns to deal with anybody, men or women, but especially with women. So, you know, we were dumped on the world in 1954 with the interaction skills, the relational skills of late teenagers. And we had to grow up in an awful hurry. Some of us did, some of us didn't.
Just at a time in a man's age when he's thinking about dating and shortly marrying and starting to really get very involved in his own sexuality, you, as someone who was preparing to be a priest, was learning about celibacy. Were you given any counseling on how to control the sexually awakened feelings that any man of that age would experience?
Not really. It was mostly behavior mod again. Repression, repression, repression. Don't get involved with women. Avoid them. Don't become friendly with them. They're dangerous. They're a threat to your vocation. This wasn't at our seminary, another seminary. The rector told the students, remember that every woman is a womb waiting to be fecundated, which I say is certainly offensive. I think it would have been offensive even in those days to many of us. Now, I should hasten to add, before people tune the radio off, that the seminaries aren't that way anymore. They're much, much different and improved. I'm not sure whether they're exactly what I'd like a seminary to be, because I don't think they're even now places of intellectual preparation. But they're certainly not as bad as the behavior mod seminary of the middle 50s.
What are your opinions now on celibacy for priests? Do you think that priests should have a celibate life?
Yeah, I'm asked, would you do it again? And that's a very tricky question. Given what I know now, yes. But at that age in life, if it was a pure free choice, I'm not so sure whether I would have chosen it then. I don't know. But I'm personally committed to celibacy. I think it's a powerful witness in the church, not because marriage is wrong, not because women are wrong, but because it represents a special sort of dedication and a special kind of freedom. My solution to the problem of priests, well, first of all, I think we ought to ordain women. I have no problem with that at all. But I also think we should realistically realize that with the increased life expectancy, we perhaps can't ask people to be priests all their lives, at least to be active priests. So I've advocated something like a priest corps, comparable with the Peace Corps. Come and be a priest for 5 or 10 years, renewable. And if you've given us a certain segment of your life, And then you're burned out. You can't stand teenagers anymore, which at 40 is a common enough reaction. And you want to do something else. You want to start a family. Then we thank you, and you go forth with dignity and gratitude. Still, indeed, in principle, the priest, but now no longer held to priestly worker obligations. I think that would solve our problems overnight. You see, until, well, about 150 years ago in the Western world, and more recently than that in other parts of the world, the typical priest lived to be about 35. Life expectancy wasn't much longer. So to be a priest for all your life was 10 years. Now it's 50 on the average. So I think we have to take into account both the different demands on priests today and the much greater life expectancy and sort of factor that into our calculus when we decide what we want of priests.
The first parish you were assigned to was, I think, suburban Chicago. It was a prosperous, middle-class Irish neighborhood, and I got the impression you were prepared for a more working-class, immigrant neighborhood. Did it change your sense of what your role was supposed to be, knowing that it was a more prosperous, and I think it was like fourth-generation Irish? It
Third and fourth-generation college-educated professional, but still very Irish. Yeah, I would say Christ the King Parish in the Beverly District of the 19th Ward of Chicago is one of the two or three great formative influences on my life. It was and is a magic neighborhood, and I was just dazzled. It was one of the first, mind you, this is 9 years after the end of the Second World War, it was one of the first college-educated parishes, and it was an active, challenging, fascinating place. It was like nothing for which we'd been prepared. And while I wasn't a sociologist then, I had read enough sociology to know that this is where Catholicism was going, that we were leaving behind the old neighborhoods, the immigrant neighborhoods, and we were going through a major social transformation. And as Everett Hughes, who was a professor at the University of Chicago and later would become one of my mentors there, said, study your parish very carefully, Father Greeley, and take notes on it, because that's the Catholicism of the future. And of course, he was right.
You were an assistant pastor, and you describe your pastor there as being very jealous and suspicious. What were some of the ways that jealousy and suspicion were expressed?
Well, the poor man, he was not in good health. His hearing was failing. He knew the church was changing, and while in principle he was favor of the changes, they made him nervous. And it was his parish. He'd founded it. It was his people. And he viewed each associate pastor, assistant pastor, I guess we were in those days, as a threat. And so he did his best to keep us away from the people. He wouldn't let us say the last two Masses on Sunday, where most of the people came. He brought in Carmelite monks to say those Masses. He wouldn't let us stand back at church and talk to the people. He pretty much prevented me from relating to any of the adults in the parish. I could go to Christian Family Movement group meetings, but that was about all. I was given the kids, or the teenagers were given me. Teach in the grammar school, work with the teenagers, and that was about it. And stay in the rectory and wait for phone calls. As a matter of fact, when I would go out in the afternoons to visit the local hospitals on foot, because he wouldn't let me have a car, he would be very suspicious. Well, now, where were you this afternoon? Well, I went to Little Company Mary Hospital. Well, how do I know that? I said, geez, you could follow me. It was a very, very strange relationship. And I did not confront it with the maturity I should have.
You gave absolution to people who told you in confession that they were using birth control.
Mm-hmm.
This was not part of what you were supposed to do. How did you decide to do that?
Well, for the first 10 years or so, Terry, people would confess it and say they were going to try not to do it again. And you would give them absolution. That was routine practice. It was a real bind for us, and I feel awfully sorry for some of the people that I could have been more helpful to and wasn't. Because on the one hand, we knew how important sex was in their marriage for healing and renewing. On the other hand, we had these rules that we really thought were unchangeable, and they thought were unchangeable. And so looking back on it, there was something of a charade about it. What happened in the middle 60s with the Vatican Council is and Pope Paul VI would not, the bishops of the world wanted to discuss the issue, and if they'd been permitted to discuss it, they would have changed the rule. The Pope wouldn't let them discuss it, but he set up a commission that was supposed to advise him. He was really looking at that point for a way to change. Well, the very act of setting up a commission, you see, suggested that it was changeable. And the lay people took their cues from that, and we did too. I read a book by John Noonan, who was now professor at Cal Berkeley at that time, on the history of the church's attitudes towards contraception. I was astonished to find that at other times in the history of the church, the position was much less insisted on than it was at that time. Where all through 19th century France, the Vatican kept telling the French clergy not to trouble the lay people on these matters. The French were controlling their population with coitus interruptus, and then the Vatican was saying, don't trouble them. Don't ask questions about the marriage practices of the laity. And so that made me realize that there was a relativity to the particular position we were taking then. And so in the years, I would say between 1965 and 1970, we had a revolution in the attitudes of the lay people and the lower clergy on birth control.
But by that time, you were already out of the parish.
Well, but I was still doing parish work on weekends. And you know, it was people would call me, even though I'd been transferred away from Christ the King, people would call me, people I'd taught in grammar school or hung around the high club, and say, well, Father, I'd like to ask you kind of a personal question. And, of course, I knew what was coming. And I would say, what do you think in your own conscience? Well, in my own conscience, I don't think, well, follow your conscience, which is, of course, the advice that 9 out of 10 priests in the country were giving in 1970 and are still giving.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Greeley, and he's written an autobiography which is titled Confessions of a Parish Priest. What were some of the ways your life was changed by Vatican II? Were there any principles that you had grown some accustomed to that you felt you didn't want to change, even though Vatican II had changed?
Oh, no,
them?
I wanted to change.
You wanted them changed.
I welcomed enthusiastically all of the changes of the Vatican Council. Some of the things that happened since then I'm less enthusiastic about, because I think that not so much the council itself, but a lot of priests, nuns, lay teachers, since the council have tended to throw out the baby with the bathwater. They have rejected everything in the church from before 1963. For example, Gregorian chant, huh? Beautiful, beautiful music, lovely music. We've substituted guitar music for that. Well, I have nothing against guitar music, but I think we should have saved the chant. Or the saints, which are wonderful examples of the stories of God. The Blessed Mother, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is the only female deity in the marketplace, the only mother goddess around. So I think there's a lot in our tradition that we're now going to have to rediscover, which needs perhaps to be rearticulated and be reformulated. But the Mary symbol, for example, which was the dominant symbol in the Western world for 1,500 years, is just too good to dismiss as excess ecumenical baggage. But the changes of the council itself, I welcome them enthusiastically.
You started going to graduate school, and you got, I think, your doctorate in sociology, and you started eventually doing a lot of church-related sociological research. Why did you want to go to graduate school?
Well, I had become more and more interested in this question, the social change going on in American Catholicism. And when that change was converging with the changes that were happening because of the council, it was clear that we were in a major transitional crisis, and I wanted to be equipped to understand it better and to make a contribution out of that understanding to what I thought might be a smoother change. I also was convinced, because of the priests that had influence in my thinking at that time, that if you're going to do something, you should do it well. That we ought to be professionals, not amateurs. We ought to be really good at what we're doing. And I felt you couldn't be really good at sociology so long as you were an amateur sitting in a rectory and writing out your opinions. So I wanted to go to graduate school to master the craft of social research.
In some of the studies that you've done, you've been the bearer of bad news.
Oh, boy, yes.
Does the church ever want to kill the messenger, so to speak?
Oh, I think so. But they find that I'm a moving target, and they can't nail me quite as easily as they might. The good news, of course, is that we have survived this last 30 years of transition with remarkably few losses. I mean, the defection rate from those who are born Catholic, I think, was something like 12 or 13% back in 1960. That's now 15, 16%. It hasn't changed much. And while church attendance declined sharply in the wake of the birth control encyclical, that decline leveled off in 1975. And some of the projections my colleagues and I have done would indicate that as far down as people in their early 20s now, when they're in their 40s, they'll be as likely to go to church as their parents. So we have survived this incredible period of tumult and trouble and turbulence relatively well. In fact, I think there's very little that the Vatican or the national hierarchy of the cardinals or weak poor priests can do to drive the laity out of the church. They've opted to stay in on their own terms, indeed, but they've opted to stay in. So that's the good news. The bad news is that they're staying in on their own terms, and their own terms is that they decide what it takes to be Catholic. Now, people come along and say they can't do that. Well, maybe they can't, but they do. And one of the things is that they just simply now reject, in overwhelming numbers, they reject the Church's sexual teachings.
So the Vatican does not have control over individual Catholics?
Nope. I think it never had quite as much control as it might have been thought, but certainly it doesn't anymore. In some respects, you know, in other respects, they talk about nuclear weapons, they talk about peace, that's another matter that they have a lot of influence. Talk about sex, the attitude of the typical layperson is just they don't know. They don't know what it's like. And to tell you the truth, that's the attitude of the typical parish priest. All you have to do is be with lay people, and you realize how unrealistic is the orientation of the Vatican on sexuality. I remember one of my colleagues coming into my office with a document that some minor Roman commission had issued in which they said the married lay people should be warned of the dangers of unbridled sex. And he says, don't the damn fools know that the real problem is there's too much bridled sex, and the only thing that keeps us together through thick and thin are the occasional interludes of unbridled sex, which, of course, is perfectly true. I mean, it's obvious enough to everyone, except the people in the Vatican that write documents, and they just don't know.
You started writing books, and initially they were nonfiction books, books about sociology mm-hmm. based on the studies you were doing. But then you started writing novels, which I think, at least to lay people, were a lot more, to the church too, I think were a lot more controversial than your nonfiction books, no matter what your findings were in nonfiction. And this was partially because you had introduced the subject of sex to your fiction. Did you need anybody's permission to either write or have published your novels?
No. Cardinal Stritch gave me permission to write back in the late 1950s, and it's never been revoked. But I don't think that would be taken seriously anymore. I mean, the Church no longer tries to prevent people from writing, and it realizes that to write, to express yourself, is a basic human freedom, and it can be neither taken or given away. If I was writing on theological issues, or if I was doing catechisms, then I would need approval of the works. But there's no rules that say a priest can't write novels. So I have never asked permission for it.
I believe in a couple of your novels that priests who have taken vows of celibacy actually have sexual encounters and then have to figure out what to do.
And some priests don't, too. I think a lot of the presumed scandal over this is hypocrisy. We live in an era when 20% of the men that are ordained priests have left to get married, and many of them, have had love affairs with people before they leave. It's well known. I mean, the fact that I write books about it, it doesn't shock anybody to know these things happen because they've happened in their parishes. So I think a lot of the shock was kind of a pharisaical scandal. And it happened among some book reviewers and some feature writers and some clergy. The research I've done on my readers indicate that just is not true of the ordinary readers of the books. They're not shocked at all.
It's my understanding that you've never been formally rebuked or punished by the church for any of your views or any of, for the novels you've written or for any of the disagreements you've had in the church. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Are you surprised that you've been able to be as outspoken as you are, write the novels that you have, and not be rebuked?
Well, first of all, they don't pay my salary. So they can't fire me from any position. They can't say you are no longer fit to be a professor at a Catholic university because I'm not. Secondly, my disagreements are not doctrinal. I mean, I criticize incompetence. For example, I was very critical of the late Cardinal Cody because he was closing down the inner city Catholic schools, the black and Hispanic schools in the inner city, which I thought was a terrible thing. But that's not a matter of doctrine. And the themes of my novels are solidly Orthodox Catholic themes. That human love is a metaphor for divine love. I mean, that runs all through the tradition. It goes back to St. Paul and into the Jewish scriptures. So nobody can fault that. All they can say is that the novels are inappropriate for a priest. Well, what's appropriate? Who decides what's appropriate? My own cardinal told me the summer before last that he didn't want me doing parish work in Chicago as long as I wrote novels of the sort I wrote. And so I quoted the correspondence, I quoted the research I'd done, I cited some of the serious scholarly books that are being written about my fiction. And he says, oh, no, he says, that's not my problem. My problem is not the people who read your books and may benefit from them or are not shocked by them. He said, my problem is the people who don't read them but are shocked that you wrote them. My problem is the image that people have of the books. Well, that, of course, is an impossible situation for a writer to be in. You've got to write in such a way as not to offend the people that don't read your books. And I said to him, I said, Joe, I'm going to be a priest and a writer as long as God gives me life. And he laughed. He said, I know that. So he didn't. There were never any orders. He would prefer I stop writing them, but he knows I'm not going to.
If you have certain disagreements, which you do, with the church hierarchy and the church structure, not with the theology, but mm-hmm. with the men who actually run the church, how have you been able to stay? I mean, why have you stayed? Some people stay and some people leave.
I like being a priest. I like the Catholic heritage and community. And I've been around enough in other parts of the world, the university, the book publishing world, the journalism world, to know that practically no human organization is run well. Murphy's Law is by no means limited to the church, nor Sturgeon's Law, which says in any given situation 90% of the people foul up. I mean, we're not necessarily the worst of the human corporate structures. Probably because we're so inefficient, we give the grassroots units more power by default, and hence are more effective. One of the iron rules, I think, of human organizations is the more power you have out at the grassroots, the stronger the organization is. So precisely because the Catholic Church isn't good at span of control, the typical parish priest has lots of freedom and hence is better able to deal with the problems than he would if the Pope controlled what you preached on Sunday.
That was Reverend Andrew Greeley. He's written an autobiography. It's titled Confessions of a Parish Priest, published by Simon & Schuster. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Audrey Voblaitis and Paul Keller. The program was edited by Maeve McGoran, assistance from Marty Moss-Cohen. Amy Sallet is the associate producer, Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview, or for a listing of other programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4802. That number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.